Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Sian Wickersham and Tom Breeze. Debating Childhoods with Joe Brown and Dr. Tim Clark. Hello and a warm welcome back to the podcast, where Sian and I are joined in the studio today by two guests who've come over from the University of the West of England in Bristol. Joe Brown and Dr. Tim Clark, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Good morning. Thanks for the invite, Tom.
And although I've said where you're from, I've given very few other clues to our listeners. So, Joe, would you like to start off by giving us a bit of a sense of who you are and what you do and why you're here?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So I'm Joe Brown, and I've been working in HE for, close to sort of 25 years now in a variety of places. I've been at UE for nearly 9 years now, and I'm the programme leader for our undergraduate early childhood programme there.
Do you want me to follow from there?
Yes, follow seamlessly.
I'm Tim Clark. I'm also based at the University of the West of England in Bristol. I have a background in early childhood education, and my role at UE, I've been at UE for about 6 years now, is as the Director of Research for our School of Education and Childhood. And yes, we're here to talk a little bit about our recent book publication called Debating Childhoods.
Brilliant. I'm really excited to get into some of the debates with you, but I'm also interested in how you've got to where you are today, because you're not teachers, right? So on the podcast, we often have a lot of teachers. You've got into early childhood and the early childhood HE space from different directions. So yeah, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you've come into education or not education this way?
Shall I go first? So my background is in early childhood education. So I had a role probably for about 12, 13 years before starting at UE, where I was the head of early education for a community-based charity in South Bristol. We ran two kind of community children's centres almost. So whilst doing that role, I started doing my doctorate in education, EdD, at University of Reading. And alongside that, started getting a little bit more involved at the University of the West of England, coming in and doing some kind of guest lecture slots linked to my professional role. Slight fun fact in here is that Joe was actually my lecturer when I did my undergraduate in early years education, kind of at the start of that journey. So I already had kind of some connections at the University of the West of England. Started doing some guest lecture and really enjoyed that, and that really aligned quite well with doing my doctorate. In 2019, I started as a senior lecturer, almost entirely teaching on the early childhood programmes to start with. Over the course then of my time at UE, I've kind of branched out into other spaces and teach on other programmes and become kind of more active in terms of my own research and publishing, which has kind of led me into this current role where I lead our kind of research work as a school. So yes, that's a bit about where I've come from.
Yeah, thanks. I've come from quite a zigzaggy path, I would guess. I mean, I started working in children's play services, so not necessarily just young children, not necessarily early childhood. I worked in adventure playgrounds in Bristol. I worked a little bit with the play service in Bristol, both providing play services within settings, but also going out into communities in parks. So I did a fair amount of that. And I got through to perhaps you what might call more early childhood education through that. I also spent some time in a local authority. So at the time in the 90s, and there was an awful lot of money in terms of investment in early years services. You know, they wanted to grow the sector, and there was a lot more government involvement in that. I worked for a local authority developing new provision and supporting existing provision in that. So that's my way into education. And then I spent some time in FE, in further education, teaching both FE courses and HE programmes there. And so that was my route through to early childhood. So, yeah, it's interesting because my initial interest was what you might call broader childhood. I've come to early childhood through that variety of different roles, really.
I was going to say that because adventure playgrounds, you're not really in the early childhood space there. I guess you are a little bit, but you've got the whole kind of age range there. But then it's funny, isn't it, how when you are in the play sector as sort of a more general education sector, you end up in early childhood, perhaps.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons for that is that the play sector is small and underfunded and, in my view, quite largely ignored by policymakers and decision makers. So, you know, so ultimately reality bites and it's OK, I want to stay here, but I need a job. You know, where's progression opportunities and so on. And particularly in the play sector, it's always been quite vulnerable to the policy directions of any particular government of the day. So, you know, at the start of the millennium, there was quite an input in money to improve public parks and adventure playgrounds and so on, and that money's since dried up. And the same with professional routes within play. You know, it's quite a deprofessionalised space, despite the huge commitment of the people who work in it. So, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think I would have liked to have spent more time there. reality sort of takes hold, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing for me because I'm, you know, listeners will know I'm a secondary specialist. So I tend to, you know, I've worked all my teaching career really in the 11 to 18 and older sort of space. But I'm really aware that this early childhood age phase is just absolutely fascinating because some of the pedagogies are, you know, endlessly fascinating to those of us that work in secondary, some of the really sort of groundbreaking approaches. Also, some of the sort of really big issues, you know, it's where the gap starts to appear between the haves and the have-nots, that sort of inequity gap. There's sort of questions about what we're trying to do with those children so early on. There's all sorts of kind of post-COVID issues. So, I mean, just thinking about the book that you've published, Debating Childhoods, and I noticed that important S on the end of childhoods there. You know, there's a bit of a clue there. These things never happen by accident, do they, in titles? What are the sort of big things that you wanted to kind of address with the book? If somebody picks this book up in the library or goes to the bookshop, what are the sort of things that you're going to be digging into in this book when they read it?
I mean, I think the first thing I'd say, just kind of picking up on that point around that kind of vocational focus, is we were really clear that, and it's why we're really, really positive about coming on a podcast that's aimed at a kind of teaching audience. We were really clear that the book was about focusing on early childhood more broadly and should be of interest and should act as a provocation for teachers, practitioners, students across different spaces. So there's a bit in the first chapter where we talk about actually most of the literature and most of the way that we structure programmes is around the idea that almost children only exist in these education spaces, yet the professionals that end up coming out of courses like early childhood, which has a really broad focus in terms of thinking about children in society, for example, will go off into all sorts of different routes, and that's really important and really of value. So they'll go off and they'll go into policy, into health, into social work, into adventure playgrounds, into community spaces. So one of the things that we were trying to do here really was kind of set some, and we did set them as provocations for the authors at the start, so maybe a slightly more unusual route to a book. We sat down at the start and said, we want this broader focus on childhood. We want to create a provocation that encourages students and practitioners to reflect and think about how different debates position children in society, and not necessarily here's a right answer and here's a wrong answer, but look at the complexity of this and is there a risk of oversimplifying this particular strand or debate, for example. And we were aiming that, hoping that we were engaging with a broader audience and that would be of interest at people at different stages of the curriculum in terms of teaching, different stages of career, and in supporting students to engage with issues about how we position and think about different things. So there are debates in here related to things like play, approaches to assessment, for example, how policy positions children and whether there's a kind of dominant ideology that we just don't question but actually threads through things that we do, and actually whether there is value in stepping back and thinking about, well, actually, what's the purpose and point of this. We mentioned earlier that kind of discussion around the importance of play, and often the argument that play is important because of its developmental value versus actually, sure. What value does play have as a, in terms of well-being, in terms of fun, in terms of an activity in its own right in the here and now? So what the book aims to do is, and the process that we followed in terms of doing that was, we set some provocations, some questions that were deliberately provocative for academic authors to engage with. And we said, engage with this kind of scaffold. How would you write critically? Almost a part of it is to kind of act as a pedagogical tool and almost like a kind of course textbook as well, that kind of walks students through thinking about, well, how do you think about different positions? What sources do you draw on? So we've got kind of reflective questions and case studies kind of dropped in as you go through the book, alongside hopefully making some quite complex concepts and ideas, like Joe's chapter around the relevance of neoliberalism to young children's lives, making that accessible to student readers, to practitioners, and provoking people to think, oh, actually, how does that shape the way that I interact with children, the way that I behave in my teaching role, the way that I engage with this as an idea? Mm. So that was our kind of starting concept, really.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. I'm not sure I can hugely add to that, but to pick up your point, and you're right, I think the S on the end of childhood is really intentional here. I mean, certainly my position is that I think young children's lives are increasingly co-opted by policy discourse, by ideological discourse. You know, you mentioned the sort of closing the gap, and there's obviously been a lot of focus in, say, the last 20 years around, you know, that early childhood education is a place where we'll start to address that gap, and that will lead to educational outcomes. There's a real sense, I think, and I wrote about this in the chapter that I co-authored around neoliberalism, that actually children's futures become a commodity, that in the sense that you're already a young child, so you're already quite vulnerable and have very little power in education and in wider society. But that's further imposed through policy, which I think views children very much through a developmentalist lens. So it's this idea of, well, we'll make sure we'll fill them with all the right stuff in the first few years, and then they can become, in my view, tax-paying humans. So, you know, I think that certainly underpinned my position, and I think that is a little thread that goes through. You know, whose childhood is it? So there's a sense here of, how do we write in a way that we think that children should be able to claim their childhood and have much more influence over it? But absolutely the S is there to say, they're also hugely diverse. You know, no childhood is the same as any other one. So there's a range of diverse childhood experiences. I think the danger is that S gets lost in these wider policy discourses, which is, oh, you're 4 years old, you'll need this then. So I think it's very much intentional. We really wanted, as well as providing those provocations to authors, we really wanted to try and find a thread through that was suggesting that childhood is a diverse and dynamic space and is experienced very differently by children.
And that it's okay to reflect and challenge and for students and for practice. And obviously, often, students, practitioners, teachers will be working in spaces that are regulated by policy and mean that they need to engage in certain practices, approach to things in certain ways, but that there's value in reflecting on those kind of taken for granted dominant positions of it's okay to step back and think about that kind of developmental perspective and think, well, is that all teaching is about? Is that all pedagogy is about? Is that all planning early childhood environments about? How do I move this child to the next step to get towards that next assessment, or and thinking about that in terms of, you know, future economic activity, etc.? Or can I think about this in different ways? Can I question these modes of assessment and the impacts they might have, and what that kind of, and we have a module on our program and a terminology we use quite a lot in the book, what that construction of childhood is. How is childhood constructed in this space, understood? How are children viewed? What's the purpose of education or you know, our interaction with children, or the policy positioned as, and can we step back and kind of engage critically with that? So part of what we've tried to do through the book is kind of map and scaffold that, well, how can you in a productive and evidence-based and referring to sources, etc., all the things that we would ask students to do, how can you do that when you're engaging with potentially quite complex or you're trying to challenge something which is often presented as a common sense understanding of something? So so our kind of pitch at the beginning, really, to the publisher, wasn't it, that we wanted to kind of the book to kind of move through a journey of almost scaffolding how do we engage in an academic and critical way with different issues and topics. And we kind of modelled the book. We've kind of used that Bronfenbrenner ecological systems approach to model the book, to map a journey through the chapters, starting with big social and political issues. You know, the first kind of substantive chapter on debates is around neoliberalism. So some of those earlier chapters focus on the kind of bigger picture. And then as we move through chapter by chapter, we get kind of closer and closer to the middle. And by the end chapter, we're thinking about also what does that mean in terms of what does it mean to listen to children? What does it mean to advocate for children? So we kind of move through different topics and issues. So we kind of had quite a deliberate, here's a pathway. So that also, if you're hopefully, if you get an interesting reader who's reading the book cover to cover, which we hope we'll get a few, that everything is kind of underpinned by the... So before you start reading about commercialization of childhood, for example, you've already thought about neoliberalism and how that might, what that might mean, the implications of that in terms of ideology and the way that we frame issues. So you're kind of walking through that from different perspectives. So I think we had... and one of the things we felt quite confident at the beginning, we had quite a clear picture of what it was we were trying to do. And it's mapped quite well to our teaching, so we have modules that kind of directly link to this, so we can obviously use it as reading with students, and it kind of supports as a teaching tool as well.
Yeah, I'm interested in the sort of audience for the book, because like you say, it's quite broad, right? Like, it could be people who are working in the education space purely, it could be people working in the early years space. I feel like parents, you know, like, it's an interesting kind of topic for anyone who is engaged in a childhood. And I think, yeah, by framing it through the lens of debates as well, you're sort of fronting the controversial aspects, aren't you? So both for your authors, but then also for your readers. So yeah, in terms of the audience, you might well get sort of quite a broad range of people who could be interested from perhaps different perspectives.
We would certainly hope so. We thought about that when we made the initial pitch to the publisher. I mean, clearly, considering where we work and our positions, you know, our first thought was, how do we create a textbook which might look at perhaps some quite contested and difficult, challenging topics in an accessible way for undergraduates? So that's where we started. But we were really keen to try and appeal to a wider readership. You know, we have authors in here, certainly Kate Irvin with a chapter in here on assessment from local authority. So, you know, we were certainly positioning this as saying, well, we think it has values for people who work in the field, you know, in early year settings and in schools and so on. So we were really keen to try and fill some of that space, but yeah, absolutely, parents. I would hope so as well. So I think we were keen to create a book for students, but a book for students that would also have wider interest in the field. Perhaps I'm speaking for myself. I hope we've provided a sense of balance. I think there's chapters here that are quite critical about things that are happening in policy and society around childhood. But we were also keen to task the authors with trying to find some places for hope or for challenge or for ways forward. We were keen not for it to be just a sort of diatribe on how terrible everything was. And sometimes that's a challenge. I certainly find that a challenge. But We were keen to suggest potential solutions, I think, alongside critiquing where we think we are.
And I think also avoiding that oversimplification, that sometimes you present a debate critically and you can equally oversimplify it by kind of taking it to the other extreme. I think Kate Irvine's chapter that you mentioned around assessment is a really interesting example of that. That chapter's titled The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And it kind of talks about assessment practice from three different perspectives, highlighting that it can cause inequality, it can be problematic, but also highlighting
that actually there is a necessary component of that, and we have to accept that that's part of teaching and learning practice, and so kind of provokes then the reader to think, well, I can think about that from different angles and think, well, yes, of course I still need to do this, but actually, do I need to, what can I think about in terms of how does that impact on the way that I'm interacting or the way that I'm thinking about children in any classroom setting? Or
yeah, and thinking about like a student-teacher perspective, that's exactly what we want them to be doing, right? Is to not just blindly apply things because they're seeing them, they're kind of copying what they've seen before, but to actually think critically about why is it that I'm being asked to do this particular thing?
Sure.
Is it always going to be applicable in every context?
Yeah.
Actually, is the thing itself valuable or is there a purpose behind it and I can achieve this purpose in different ways?
Yeah.
And yeah, I can imagine sort of by reading, engaging in these debates as well, you kind of get to that slightly deeper understanding of pedagogy. Although I'm thinking, like in an undergraduate course, you have the luxury of time a little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like for me, I'd be sort of looking at maybe the NQT year rather than the PGCE year, maybe, because I don't know, it doesn't really, I don't know whether Tom, you agree, it's only now, sort of we're February, that we start having some of these debates, really, isn't it? There's so much to kind of get your head around so early. But then that makes me wonder as well, have we got teachers in classes who've never really had the time and space to consider some of this stuff?
Yeah, I would talk from an English context rather than a Welsh context. I would say that over a number of years now, that teacher training, particularly postgrad teacher training, is quite a site of government control, and you know, is increasingly tightly controlled over the years in terms of the requirements and the curriculum and placement, number of placement days and so on. My personal position is that that's not accidental, right? The cynic in me would suggest that actually what governments feel they need in teachers who are people who are willing to manage a classroom and do as they're told. So, it's not particularly within the interest of policymakers to interrogate these kind of issues and have those critical discussions around exactly what you say. I'm doing this, why am I doing it? What might the impact of this be? That increasingly we've seen teacher education become teacher training in the sense that there's a set of prescribed standards, certainly in England, I don't know about the Welsh context, provide evidence, tick these standards off. And I think that is about governments wanting to control what happens within those classroom spaces. So if programmes can find spaces for these sort of debates, all the better for me. Because I think if we have teachers who are equipped to go in and go and question things and look at this, and as you say, a developing and deepening understanding of pedagogy, then we have teachers who are willing to be creative or are willing to meet the needs of diverse childhoods and so on and so forth. And for me, that's not controversial in the slightest. It might be for policymakers.
Yeah, I mean, we've had, listeners may remember, we've had Trevor Mutton on from Oxford talking about those differences between Wales and England in terms of teacher education. I mean, without wanting to kind of go into a Welsh rabbit hole here, it's interesting to look over the border. And I think there is a different sort of feeling. I mean, you're talking about neoliberalism. I suppose, shoot me down. But I think the general sense is that the English government, certainly pre the general election, I don't know about post, but certainly pre, were more sort of neoliberally inclined policy-wise than in Wales, where in the early childhood space, I suppose we had the foundation phase, very, very sort of play-based, child-centred. Of course, the critique from those on the neoliberal kind of side of the fence is, well, look over the fence to Wales where they've not been as neoliberal as us and their standards are dropping.
Sure.
Their attainment gap is widening, their reading kind of ages are dropping. I suppose I'm sort of interested in is it possible to be less neoliberal and still have successful pupils, or is it about not defining success in the way that it's currently defined?
That's a really good question. For me, neoliberalism works successfully because it's adaptable and dynamic, right? So it exists almost everywhere. It exists in slightly different forms or imposes itself in slightly different ways depending on the context it finds itself. Are Scandinavian economies neoliberal? Absolutely. Do they look like the US economy? No, they don't. But ultimately the aim's the same for me. I think you have to question what we measure, right? Because I think if you agree that governments and neoliberal economies are advancing neoliberal aims, albeit in perhaps slightly different ways, or it looks a little bit different, they are measuring what supports the arguments to continue along a path for education which meets services in neoliberal economy, essentially, right? If neoliberalism is also very good at pulling people back in line, right? It suits the agenda, doesn't it? If you have, from an English perspective, look over the border, they've got a play-based curriculum. Sounds a bit woolly and creative. Oh, no, it's fine. You know, their standards are dropping, right? And we'll continue to measure those kind of metrics. So the narrative in England is that your the evidence that your standards are dropping is manna from heaven for an English neoliberal institution, right? And those conversations are happening, aren't they, in Westminster and beyond? Well, the Welsh model's failed, so we're not going to go that way. So I think neoliberalism as a set of structures is really skilled in trying to pull people back into the lane, and part of that's absolutely through measurement, and it's also about creating really powerful truths about things like this is what education's for, and you know by extension, you know, Tim talked earlier on about. We talk about constructions of childhood. By extension, this is what childhood is for. And that's what I meant earlier on when I said that children's lives are increasingly co-opted and they're not their own. And I think they're co-opted by neoliberal structures to say this is what you exist for, ultimately. And what you exist for is to attend education and be filled with knowledge and skills so you become a complete human. And of course, that complete human then ends up contributing to the global economy. Maybe that sounds extreme. I don't think it is. I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that's what's been happening.
Yeah, I'm interested in this measuring point. Because obviously we do measure various things about childhood, don't we? But in particular, we're very focused in the education sector on attainment, measuring attainment in its various different forms and things. But what do you feel we should be measuring? What's missing currently? Or should we be measuring things at all?
Happiness? Well-being? It's interesting, isn't it? I remember back when David Cameron's government first got in, 2010 maybe? Yeah. It feels like yesterday. It's the coalition, wasn't it? The coalition was starting talking about things like well-being indices, weren't they? Actually, for adults as well as children. He came in on that, let's begin to reconceptualise what we value and so on. I mean, it turned out to be sort of relatively empty rhetoric, which surprised perhaps none of us. But there have been those discussions bubbling up about what do we measure and what do we value. I think there's been less of that within the education system. This was more societally. But there is very much a space, isn't there, where we say we measure what we try and measure success in terms of the sort of outcomes in terms of children's learning, but we don't. But it seems separate to the child in a way. We're not measuring anything that really uses or attempts to elicit the child's voice, right? And happiness and well-being is one of those things. But assessment in education is something that is done to you. It doesn't feel particularly collaborative. You're not listening to the child. I'm perhaps quite skillfully skirting around your actual question, which is what you would measure.
But also I think those last couple of questions are really good questions, and they illustrate the fact what we're trying to do the book and say these things are complex, and actually listening to different perspectives and opinions on this is helpful in terms of reflecting and thinking about practice, but not saying actually we should or we shouldn't be doing this, or this is a disaster or it's brilliant, or there are and one of the things we tried to do in terms of the guidance for the authors was not just reducing all of the provocations to a binary argument. These are all, there's a spectrum of thinking in relation to all of these things, and it's not a question of should, it might not necessarily be a question of should we be measuring at all, but there's a kind of spectrum of how we do that and what we look at, and I think
what
that,
we value.
That kind of runs again through the book. It's why actually, and you were saying just now, does this sound too extreme? Part of what we want to do with the book is be provocative. Say, actually, what if there was a world and this did look completely different at the other end? What would be the implications of that? What would that mean? Because what that does is makes visible, well, what are the assumptions and constructions that underpin where we are now? Because there's not a universal position and it must look like this. It could look different ways. It does look different ways in different countries, in different historical periods, etc. This is where we are now, but that must still operate within an environment where it's healthy to question and reflect on that and think, actually, here's the policy, how am I applying this in this space, this classroom, with this group? So I think it's good to have to be provocative and have those kind of different perspectives in there, but I don't think there are simple answers to any of these things. And I think also we have to be conscious that hopefully there's an audience reading the book who will be engaged in different sectors, different roles, and they'll have different constraints and regs. So there are some chapters where we kind of do directly address the point that actually maybe that challenges your position on that, but maybe you've got no control about what you can actually do about that within your professional role or
environment. But think about it nonetheless.
But yeah. Think and reflect, and it might be really kind of nuanced micro things that we do, that we approach things differently. And actually, I am using this assessment, but I don't treat as fact that this box is ticked and therefore that is exactly who that child is and where that child is now. But I take that into context and think about that in a more nuanced way. And that might be the limitation of how far that reflection can go because of constraints around any given professional or environment.
But there's perhaps a different question, isn't there? Rather than what would you measure, perhaps how would you measure? I think in early childhood in particular, there's a big problem with standardised assessment in the sense that pathway that children are on from, say, birth to five is so steep and quick and varied and diverse that I can't see how we've got to a position where it's taken as a truth that you measure children on the same thing at the same age and that's some sort of accurate judgment of where children are. Quite aside from, you'll have a child who is August born and a child who is September born who are almost a year apart and they're only in the fifth year of life and you're measuring them on the same thing at the same time. I don't accept a system whereby the conversation is that's fine. I mean, quite aside from what it does to children, ignore all of that. How can we see that as any accurate measure? Ooh, they can't do what that child can do. They're falling behind all those sort of narratives of, what interventions do we put in place? Well, they're a year younger for a start.
Yeah, I have this conversation on the playground all the time with anxious parents talking about their summer-born children and particular their sort of aptitude for reading and writing and things, my son's in year one now, so it's quite topical. And again, he's slightly older in the year.
Sure.
But I'm often saying to them, a year ago, he wouldn't have been doing that. So the fact that your child's not doing it, don't worry, he's a year younger. And it's something that, like you say, it creates a lot of anxiety for a whole number of people, for the teacher as well, potentially, although you'd say they probably should be aware of who's summer born, but I think as well there's sort of a question, isn't there, around what is happening and then also maybe what should be happening. And that's another kind of perhaps a nuance for people to think about, actually what is going on when I'm doing that. But then also, sure. Is that the right thing? Not that and there might be many different right things.
And I guess the starting point is the openness for there being debates around those things. Yeah. And again, at the heart of this. I mean, I think...
Well, back to Tom's point, right? Childhoods.
Yeah.
They're all different.
I think in some ways, kind of going back to thinking about training routes and the spaces for doing this, we have the luxury in an early childhood programme that this is a core focus of the whole degree, isn't it? And many of the students from early childhood will go on to do PGCEs with this.
And with we this love it when they do.
But at the same time, I think we're conscious that this is coming in the context that early childhood and childhood studies degrees have a kind of tricky positioning in the current higher education climate because they're not and we've deliberately protected ours isn't a vocational program on the assumption that every single person coming out of that is going to go into early years, be an early years practitioner or teacher. So to protect that kind of broad focus and think about things like sociology of childhood and children in context of things like the law and things like that, the flip side of that is that means you have quite a broad cross-cutting program. But in terms of thinking about the kind of ways, the metrics and the way the programme itself is measured in terms of what are the professional routes, what's the kind of vocational trajectory, why would I invest in doing an early childhood degree? It's a slightly broader landscape. And I think we are conscious that that means in some context you see kind of rebranding of what used to be large early childhood programmes at other institutions that become either childhood education and youth type pathways or they become a more vocational route. They are an early years education route. But I think one of the things that we really value and think is really important about the design and the way that the programme works at the University of the West of England is it is broad, it is multidisciplinary, it is cross-cutting. We are starting with that focus of a kind of an acknowledgement that students may be going on into all sorts of different routes and careers and not that here's a group of people who will definitely all be your early years practitioners. And it kind of starts with that underpinning rather than jumping straight into modules that are all about practice and pedagogy. We're starting with sociology of childhood. How is childhood constructed? How do we understand the child in society?
One of the chapter headings that really caught my eye is play, investment or pleasure. And I was just really interested. Could you give us a little sneak peek of what sort of in that chapter? Is it an investment or is it purely for pleasure? It really kind of piqued my interest.
Yeah, good. Yeah, so this was written by colleagues at Birmingham City University, and it was great that we were able to get colleagues from other places to contribute. Essentially, this is really broadly around how adults view what play is for. So in terms of investment, the argument is that play or aspects of play or types of play perhaps have been co-opted by education systems to provide particular outcomes. So this idea of play investment is that we privilege some forms of play over others, and they tend to be the ones that adults construct as being useful for development or useful for learning or controllable or some sort of adult-led idea. And there's a number of writers who write on that. Elizabeth Wood is an obvious one. They talk about how play is seen as an investment in the future. If you do the right kind of play within early childhood, then you're able to adapt to later schooling and so on and so forth. Obviously, the alternate view of that is positioning play as something quite different, which is play, which is something which is directed by the child and chosen by the child. Perhaps the language we might hear in early childhood settings is sort of free play. So it's free play, it's owned and directed by the child, and it's something the child does because they have an innate biological drive to play and to explore the world through that. So it's sort of picking up on those two positions of play, really, the chapter, and saying, well, where are we? How do these two ideas of play interact? What are some of the challenges with enabling children to have more control over their play choices and so on? And I think that's true within education and outside of education, actually. There's still forms of play in a park or in a street that would perhaps be deemed as acceptable by adults and play that wouldn't be deemed as acceptable. So I think that's the heart of that debate, is where play is in society. Essentially, my position is I don't particularly like the term free play. I understand why it's used. For me, something is either play or it isn't, right? I perhaps take quite a purist position because I come from a play background and that's where I started my career in working with children. But for me, if play isn't free and directed and owned by the child, then it's not play. It's something else. It might be playful, And but if it's has some level of control by adults, so they get specific outcomes or try and get specific outcomes out of it, my personal view is it's not play. Now, you know, there are other positions, aren't there? And other people might take a more pragmatic position about that and say, well, it is still play, but we need to recognise the impact the adult has and so on. And maybe taking a pragmatic position in education is much more sensible. You know, I'm in a hugely privileged position in this programme, and so I don't have to take that position.
I think it's something the student teachers really grapple with.
Yes.
So the way that our PGC primary programme works is they do two placements in two different age phases, but our age phases are nursery and reception, so 3 to 5, and then year 1, 2, 3, and then 4, 5, 6.
Okay.
So some of them won't actually do a placement with 3 to 5 year olds. They could not. But sometimes when they do, you really see the dichotomy, essentially.
Sure.
You see half of them that totally get it and they're bought in and they're like, why can't we do more of this in year 5? You know, we should be all outdoor learning. We should be doing all of this stuff. And then you get lots of them that really, really struggle to actually reconcile what they understand about learning and education with what they're observing and what they're doing.
Sure.
And sometimes they'll say things to me like, but Sean, I'm not doing any teaching.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I'll say, okay, like let's talk about this. And we have to go there. We have to go to, you know, what
interesting
what
discussion
teaching?
There, right? What's the role of the
absolutely.
Teacher?
Absolutely. But it really sort of, it always makes me reflect, because it happens basically every year that I'll have a couple of student teachers who find this really challenging, this transition. Mm. The fact that we don't prepare them for it. Mm. And we focus on the sort of what it looks like in the majority, perhaps, of the primary school.
Mm.
But actually, they all need to know, right? They need to know where we're coming from.
Absolutely.
And also the principals need to follow.
Mm. Absolutely. And of course, you know, in England, we have a really weird system whereby, you know, we have the EYFS up until the end of reception and then in year one. So from a child's perspective, as well as a teacher's perspective, here you go, have the play, here's the play, stop that now. Right, new curriculum, sit down.
We're doing proper learning.
Yeah, you know, imagine if you're 5 years old, that I've left in July and I've come back in September and it's like a different school.
Let alone the transition to secondary doors, which is even more.
Which is also huge. So, yeah, we have a weird relationship with play, I think, within education. And it's come from that, you know, odd mix of policy and different curriculums. But yes, that discussion around adult-led, child-led is as old as the hills, isn't it? You know, where is the balance? What is my space in this as an educator? And so on. I mean, fantastic that we're having those discussions and fantastic that you're having them on your programme, and long may they continue. Because I think it's huge. It's a hugely important part of early childhood education.
What about parents? Because they're not necessarily pulling on the side of let's have more play and fewer outcomes. There's often, you know, a self-imposed pressure, I think, on some parents to, oh gosh, you know, I think the question I always used to get asked as a music teacher is, what, are you giving them any homework? Or, you know, and I'd be saying, well, no, because there's nothing I can do. But I often used to find that parents were sometimes some of the most old school kind of punters of all in the business.
I suppose, I mean, I'm just thinking that also links, doesn't it, to some of the kind of bigger issues and the wider discourse that we pick up on in some of those earlier discussions, in that, you know, how much of that is influenced by policy positions and what we hear in the media, and, you know, almost like there's a kind of race, education's a race, you know, and there's a risk that if we're not doing this or this now, then we're, you know, my child's going to be left behind. So I think that is entangled in the same issues, isn't it? That there is a narrative through the media, through politicians, through various sources that kind of align with that idea that we were talking about earlier in terms of the purpose of education. And, you know, right at the heart of that, the purpose of childhood is a preparation for becoming a successful adult, rather than actually we are also going to think about that in its own right. So I think that is also part of the kind of cultural context, isn't it, of childhood in the UK and in England, Wales, and how you can't separate those, you know, we're talking about these things in relation to that kind of micro interactions and how we might interact with parents and respond to that, but actually that in that Bronfenbrenner model, that's kind of enclosed by that wider discussion and discourse, isn't it?
Yes, 100%. I would, and perhaps I would obviously say that, but that communication needs to happen, right? I'm thinking about my two youngest children, their primary school, and actually that the reception teacher was extremely skilled in having those conversations with worried parents. Oh, he can't write his name yet. Or, you know, worried about the counting. And actually, it was a particularly playful class. She came from an early childhood background, the reception teacher there. But I think those conversations matter. With much harder in secondary, of course, but in primary, those conversations matter, don't they, with parents? The teachers actually take the initiative to perhaps sort of allay fears and talk about how this works, and, you know, perhaps try and undermine some of that education as a race or falling behind narratives that we see. I think they're really important. Add to the workload of teachers, but I do see that that's part of that role, isn't it? Is to engage with the, as Tim says, the context around the child.
And there's a big difference in communication expectations when you start school compared to sort of a kind of more like a nursery, a private nursery setting, where you've got an app where you're finding out every single thing about that child, maybe more than you actually want to know that happened that day. You're seeing photos, and then you're also having a debrief at the end of the day, usually.
Sure.
And then you go to parents' evening twice a year. Again, just because I've turned four.
Sure.
So the importance of those kind of communication events, those getting the parents in, parent and child kind of working alongside each other, kind of those things. But again, in schools where we're time poor, we're money poor as well, often it is the first thing that drops off, isn't it? The
option.
Yeah, of course.
Is it because, the sort of neoliberal approach, the race approach, the less communication approach, at least it's cheap, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and it meets the aims, right? That's ultimately how it's judged. Or you're constantly pressing for it to meet the aims better, I guess. But yeah, it probably is a cheap approach, isn't it?
That's a negative note to end on. But
sorry.
No, I was just sort of thinking, you know, we discuss all kinds of really sort of big and interesting issues in this room. And I always seem to end up at the conclusion that actually we're not spending enough on this stuff. You know,
absolutely not. Totally agree.
The policies that we're seeing for our upcoming elections seem to be, you know, long on short term, you know, bursaries to get people into the profession and that sort of thing, and quite short on the sort of massive kind of redirecting of the resources that we have that perhaps, you know, some of the things you're talking about here would sort of imply.
Yes, it would. And, you know, you're an ex-music teacher, right?
Yeah.
And you teach music now. For me, that's what's happened to music education is neoliberalism in a nutshell. Right? What value to the global economy does creativity have? Get rid of it or minimise it or play it down. It's not an accident that it's difficult to recruit music teachers, or that, you know, numbers are low on music teacher education programs, or, you know, schools are struggling to find time for music. That is precisely what's meant to happen, I'm afraid. You know, PE is another one. There's lots of those. This relentless focus from primary on maths, English and science, that's slightly expanded when you get to secondary, but we're pretty much in that space, is about the global economy. Nothing else. It's not about children.
And I am interested as well that with the curriculum for Wales, in theory, as a school leader, as a teacher, I could not do that. You know, I could do whatever I want with my curriculum, really.
Total autonomy.
They've got total autonomy. But they're not.
No.
You know, we're not. We're still...
Well, that's the pervasive, hidden nature of the big macro structures, right? It's sort of this debate between structure and agency. You know, how much are we controlled by these big hidden structures? How much agency do I have? You know, in reality, you're saying, well, curriculum for Wales, they have lots of agency to make those choices, but almost all of them don't make them.
No.
Well, that's the structure winning.
Yeah, I've often felt that, you know, whatever else you may say about the England education system, at least they're honest about what they say. Whereas over here, it could be argued that, you know, there's the illusion of a massive sort of amount of autonomy and agency.
But schools are schools are in a competitive system as well, right?
Yeah, especially secondary. But yes, one of the things that has interested me recently is the fact that, you know, we hear a lot of stuff in the sort of national conversation about all kinds of things, but education and childhood and things like that tend not to figure as much as, say, growth. You know, that elusive growth that all of our politicians want. Mm. And when we do hear about children, young people in the news or in the discussion, one of the sort of main things we hear about them is that they're very, very unhappy. They're sort of not very well in a sort of holistic sense, and that our sort of slightly older young people are, you know, large chunks of them appear to be kind of kicking back against the situation in which they find themselves. And if we assume for a moment that it's not necessarily what you would read in the right-wing press, which is that they're all just a bunch of lazy snowflakes, it would suggest that perhaps there is, you know, thinking back to your kind of neoliberalism get in line point, perhaps there is a sort of failure going on somewhere, that these young people appear to be very unhappy and they appear to be in various ways rejecting the status quo, all this stuff about quiet quitting and all that kind of thing. I suppose if you're talking about questions, and you're talking about the sort of, you know, I'm thinking about the macro and the micro here. We're at an interesting point in time here because we're about to have some fairly seismic elections in which we may see, 25 years of Labour rule since devolution may come to an end, if the polls are to be believed. So at the sort of macro level, what should people be asking who are going to have their hands on the levers of education policy here fairly shortly? Because I've read a lot of their offerings that have come out so far, and there's not a huge amount that's sort of massive and ambitious there. But then at the micro level, someone who's in a classroom and hasn't got much control over stuff, what questions should they be asking?
Well, the first question that policymakers should ask is why are children unhappy? I'm not convinced they will. But that's the place to start. As someone with an early childhood and play background, the more pertinent question is who to ask. They need to ask children. That's the missing voice often in an education system, or indeed in wider policy around that involves children's social policy. We don't ask children enough questions, and we certainly don't actively listen. I think, you know, there's plenty of evidence just when you do ask children, they're quite positive about generally about education and about learning and about the future, but they don't necessarily feel that the system is geared towards them as children. And I would agree with them, I have to say. So, it's not what you ask necessarily, it's who you ask. We have to start moving, I think, more towards an education system that's, I know this sounds an odd thing to say, but that which is underpinned by the needs and wants and voices of children rather than suits in Westminster or Cardiff or wherever, to be honest. That's where I'd start. I don't think it's going to happen. But I think children's unhappiness stems from it's complex. It's, you know, it's from lots of places. I think the education system is one. You know, I think inequality is another big driver. You know, and the UK has quite a poor record on inequality. I think, you know, there's a chapter in the book around the commercialisation of childhood. I think that sort of commercialisation and particularly a very hot debate at the minute around social media and, you know, phone and screen time and all of those things. I think they all contribute to perhaps a world that sometimes feels quite oppressive for children in terms of the demands and the expectations of the education system and then the sort of demands and expectations of things like social media and consumerization. I don't think it's a particularly child-friendly world that we've created, is my view. Are you going to answer his second question? Because I've singled.
Yes, I was just going to say picking up, and I think. Well, I was going to link it to
something you mentioned earlier about the kind of challenge we had initially in terms of how we were approaching the book and how we were pitching the book, is that in the context of that and in the context of some of the debates we're thinking about, I think that can, from if we're thinking about readers as students, newly qualified teachers, for example, that can feel quite, taking that position can feel quite demoralising and depressing, you know, what can I actually do within this microenvironment in this space? So part of our kind of response to that was to try to weave through the book using things like reflective questions, the things that are, you know, what can I control? What can I do? How do I think about listening to children? How do I advocate for children's rights in this space? Those kind of things. But I think that, yeah, there is a danger we were fully aware of, that, and that was that point earlier about hope, that we had that discussion earlier. The book has to offer some kind of hope and practical perspectives and not get so tied into, well, this is all impossible and it's all too big and how can we influence and change this, and kind of, you know, are we too far down the tracks to do anything about these things? So
Tim's come for the hope. Yeah. I provide the hope.
Good cop, bad cop. Yeah.
So I think at that, so the aim in the book at that kind of micro level is to first and foremost kind of encourage reflections and think about how those policies, practices, pedagogies are enacted within those spaces with the, you know, the things that we can control with the groups of and classes of children that we're working with.
That's more positive, and how, right?
Yeah.
That, I think the micro level, you can do more things. Mm-hmm. It's sorry to interrupt you, but, you know, we are able to disrupt, aren't we? And do things slightly differently or think things in slight ways. I think if you think about that macro question, it feels really big and it's bound up with other agendas. But, you know, that teachers may feel controlled but when you're in your class with the children that you've developed relationships, there's absolutely incredibly positive little micro disruptions that you can undertake, can't you, to give those children at least while the time are in your classroom a good experience as you possibly can within the structures that already exist, you know. So I don't think, hopefully there's no message in the book saying to make this better we have to change the world. We do, of course, but on an individual level, right, we can change perhaps a little corner of it. And I think that's positive.
Yeah. And I think if a reader picks it up and engages with some of those issues and just comes away thinking, these things are a little bit more complex and a little bit more nuanced than perhaps I thought beforehand, something like assessment, for example, hopefully that will have some impact in supporting reflection and practice. However, you know, even if that's really minor changes to the way that we perceive and receive information or engage with some of these processes, because I think we also have to be mindful, particularly if the core, and I know you said audience potentially could be broad, but the assumption is the core audience for the book are likely to be undergraduate students, newly qualified teachers, new practitioners, there will be constraints and limitations on how much control and agency you have, particularly at that, you know, if you're a student on placement in an early childhood setting or in a school, for example, in terms of the amount of agency and autonomy and authority that you have actually to think about the way things are done at that stage of your career, that's more likely to be more limited, isn't it? But actually, if that starting point allows us to go into those environments and think, well, how's that enacted and how does that work here and what does that mean for that group of children? That's hopefully the starting point of being a reflective teacher who, as you develop through your career and think about different strategies and approaches and gain more autonomy and agency, allows that to inform and underpin.
Yeah, start causing trouble once you've got a full-time job.
Yeah, I'm often struck by actually, you do have quite a lot of control. This might be different primary, secondary, but as a primary teacher, you can do quite a lot within the classroom that you've got. Like, you can set a lot of the structures. And I think as a head teacher as well, and if you're in a leadership position, it's one of the jobs where you can sort of develop your own kind of little, your own little utopia, can you? And we've sort of got a few wonderful head teachers who we work with who've definitely done that. You know, they've shaped the landscape that they're in order to create the type of school that they want to create. I remember working with a previous head teacher who had moved into sort of a local authority role, and she was really grappling with the lack of control. Yeah. She was saying, I'm used to saying, I want this to happen, and it just happens.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so I think if we've got teachers listening, which obviously we do, you know, there's hope there, isn't there, within your classroom? And also how important you are as a teacher. And again, I'm speaking from a primary perspective here. You're probably, for lots of children, you know, you're up there in the top 10 adults that they're going to interact with, maybe even the top 5. And you doing your bit and reflecting on your practice and being the very best teacher that you can be can have incredible power.
It's that big impact of little things. You know, just little changes can make a real difference to a child's life. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You've also brought the hope, and I'm thankful that there's two of you at least.
Maybe this is our dynamic.
I am very much the bad cop of the podcast. Okay, so, I mean, we could go on about this for another several hours, but we should probably be mindful of our studio booking. So we're going to move on to the short slots, especially because, in a podcast first, both guests have done both slots. So we are in an absolute cornucopia of interesting things and things to try. Tim, something interesting.
So my something interesting, I'm going to give a plug for the Early Childhood Studies Degree Network Journal, which is a student journal which I'm involved in editing and organising, which is a collection of papers that we publish each year from high quality student papers that very much engage with the types of things that are in our book, the type of debates and ideas. So do have a look, give it a read. It's on the Early Childhood Studies Degree Network, or ECSDN, website. We're just about to publish this year's issue of the journal. And I think, I hope, it kind of reflects examples of students from across the UK who are engaging in and using the benefit of the opportunities to reflect and think about some of the issues we've talked about today to construct essays or research reports and share their work to a wider audience. So it's something I'm really passionate about, really encourage our students at UWE to engage with, because I just think it's such a great opportunity to showcase student perspectives and student engagement with this. So yes, do have a look at the latest issue. There's all sorts of back copies and things on there exploring different ideas and issues, and perhaps great for students in terms of thinking about how we might approach different issues and topics in our own assignments. So
that's
my something interesting.
Yes, there's nothing that cheers me up quite as much as a student absolutely knocking it out of the park. I mean, thinking about our Research Bites episodes when they come in here, it's just great, isn't it? Brilliant that you've got that going on. Joe, what's yours?
Well, I'm taking a bit of a left turn. I've not picked anything to do with early childhood
Good.
Or education.
We like those.
In a way. So in my spare time, I very much enjoy visiting Neolithic stone circles. I'm really interested in the sort of development of early humans and so on. I'm about halfway through a book called The Tale of the Axe, which is by an academic called David Miles. And he traces this Neolithic hand axe that he was given, the stone from it, and he traces it back to early humans and forward to the advent of farming and so on. So it's a sort of tale of the development of humanity through this axe. But there's a chapter on conceptual thinking, which is really interesting. They're suggesting, through the development of larger brain size and so on, that early human-type creatures were able to think conceptually. So this idea that if I'm creating a tool in advance, it's because I've conceptually worked out what I need it for in the future. Whereas things like chimpanzees, creatures like chimpanzees use tools very differently. Here's something handy lying around. So it's this illustration of conceptual thinking. The argument is that's what makes us human. Because once we start thinking about concepts, we can start planning for the future. Also, once we start thinking conceptually, we think about things like music and art and representation and so on. So I guess there is some overlap, but really interesting for me about essentially what makes us human.
Oh, sounds fascinating. I've written the title down. I'll definitely be checking that
out. It's great, yeah. Mm.
Okay, so now we've got our something to try. Should we switch it up? Should we swap round? Do you want to go first, Joe?
Sure. I mean, this may well not be anything that people don't know already, but I've bought to try the user experience fishbowl, which I'm sure educators may have come across. We're really keen on the programme to push two ideas. One is that every student on the programme has something really valuable to offer, and we should offer as many spaces as possible to try and disrupt that knowledge transmission model. You know, the lecturer is the expert, providing information and you write it down and so on. So there's that, and also this understanding that we all have funds of knowledge. So we all bring something very useful to the party, whatever that is. So we are within our program, we use user experience fishbowl from time to time. So people who've had experience or knowledge of something, whatever that is, sit in a circle. And then the people who don't have as much knowledge or experience of that thing sit around the outside. The people in the inner circle just talk. They just share ideas about this concept or this idea, and then the people around the outside can ask questions. Now, it's really successful with adults. It's absolutely something we should also do with children. It's a posh name for circle time, right? With it, to borrow an early Chartered. But I think the principles of trying something which really tries to elicit voices of children within settings and also positions them as experts in particular topics is something really important. So user experience fishbowl, you can find it online if you just Google it. Try it. See what happens.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I feel like I've done versions maybe with children. But yeah, something we should definitely be doing with the student teachers more. Thank you. And over to you, Tim.
So my something to try is visual journaling. I'm really interested in my own work, in my own research in arts-based research and using visual methods, particularly in narrative research, so capturing stories in different ways. And in a couple of recent projects, I've used things like storyboards. I'm working with a doctoral student at the moment who's using zines with groups of teachers to think about their professional identity. And I just think there is something about trying to capture in visuals, you know, in a storyboard format or kind of trying to visualise in response to a question and in response to being reflective about things, maybe even in relation to some of the topics we raise and kind of taking a position on that in terms of the debates, that just makes you think differently and makes you think maybe more slowly and kind of dwell on, well, how do I crystallise and understand that, or how might I use metaphor to reflect that? And I've just found my experience in a lot of the recent research that I've been doing is just people seem to present and engage with questions and reflections in a different way when we open that out to actually I can visualise that, I can map that, I can, you know, it's a combination of words and images, for example. So I just think it's worth trying, because I think it supports that reflection and can maybe break down some of those things when we think, you know, if we're doing written journaling and we have that kind of longer narrative, we might position or communicate in a different way. So yeah, that was my something to try.
Amazing. Thank you very much. I don't think we've ever had such a collection of interesting things and things to try. That brings us to the end of this very interesting discussion. We do hope that you will go away and do some debating of childhoods. If you're interested in actually getting hold of the book, it's called Debating Childhoods, Critical Perspectives on Early Childhood, and it's published by Sage. Thank you very much to Joe Brown and Dr. Tim Clark from University of the West of England who've joined us in the studio today. We hope you enjoyed today's little set of micro disruptions.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming, guys.
And from good cops over there and the bad cops over here, we will be back with you in 2 weeks. Bye for now. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Sian Wickersham and Tom Breeze. The special guests this episode were Joe Brown and Dr. Tim Clark from the University of the West of England, and thanks to them for coming in. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambin and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.